Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. All right, let's go to this week's Corona Calls. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to new developments in the world of COVID-19 and other infectious diseases. Joining us, Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley's School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
Let's start with the more exciting news headline. The World Health Organization sent out a report last week of an avian influenza and H5N1 case in a human in Mexico that proved fatal, which on the surface of it sounds much more serious than the extremely minor symptoms experienced by the cases in farm workers, dairy workers reported here in the United States. What do we know about this case? Is this a development to be more concerned by?
Sure. We don't know a lot about it. We've had the WHO report, and we've heard from the CDC as well. It's not the same organism, same type of influenza, avian influenza, that's circulating here in cattle and has spread to 4 people over the last couple of years here in the United States. So it's a different variant of influenza. We know that there's evidence that some cats in the area were also infected. In addition to cows, and we don't know too much about the person who died, the gentleman who died. He was in his middle years. He had a respiratory infection and died within 24 hours of hospitalization. We haven't seen any secondary cases, meaning we haven't seen other people around him becoming ill. So that's what we know. But to put that in perspective, we have seen cases of people dying from avian influenza, the various different types, now recorded well since 1995. And there's been just under 1,000 people who have died from this. So it's not surprising in that case. I think that it doesn't change how we're looking at this virus in terms of what's happening here in the U.S. and what's happening around the world with H5N1. We should all, as you and I discussed and have been discussing, Brian, we should all be concerned about this. We should be putting a lot of resources into understanding how this virus is spreading and how to stop it, and also how to prevent it with vaccines. And all these things are being done right now. The encouraging thing on the more general perspective about H5N1 is that here in the U.S., we've only seen this year the 3 cases, and there was one in 2022, but we haven't seen any further evidence of spread. We need to look more carefully to see if we can see evidence of spread, but we haven't seen any serious disease from this beyond these 3 cases that weren't real serious. So that's where we are for concern, but certainly we don't see any evidence that this is, at least yet, been able to figure out a good way to get into humans and then from human to human spread.
2 things that caught my attention from the case report in Mexico. The thing that made me breathe easier was that the person who died had apparently been sick enough from something else that they were bedridden for 3 weeks leading up to their hospitalization and death with avian influenza. But the thing that made me more concerned was that there was no obvious path of exposure for this person. It's not someone who was like working with a dairy herd or a chicken farm.
That's right. It was as far as we can tell, random. That is, there was no evidence of any exposure to other animals, including birds or cats and cows. So that is disconcerting. On the other hand, we've looked at people around him, at least That's what's been reported, and we haven't seen any evidence of spread. So right now, I think our feet are pretty firmly planted in the air in terms of how this person got influenza and why he had such a bad outcome.
All right, second topic I want to touch on before we get into listener questions. Actually, I should give the phone number out before I do. 1-800-958-9008 if you've got questions about avian influenza, COVID-19, or other things you probably don't want to get sick with. That's 1-800-958-9008 for your corona calls. Last week, the FDA's Vaccines and Related Biological Products Committee, with the extremely easy-to-manage acronym VRBPAC, conducted a day of public deliberations to go over data from COVID vaccine manufacturers on the safety and efficacy of updated versions of their vaccines, and ended the day by unanimously recommending updated vaccines be produced for this fall, with a question mark as to whether those vaccines would be manufactured to target JN.1, which is a recently dominant subvariant, or the so-called flirt subvariants, KP.2 and KP.3. First of all, any surprises in the data that came up in the public deliberations?
No surprises at all. This is exactly what we expected. I think you and I talked about this 2 or 3 weeks ago. The World Health Organization in May recommended that the new vaccine for the fall, the updated vaccine for the fall, be based upon JN.1. And I think the only thing that I was looking for in this meeting was whether the VRBPAC, this advisory committee to the FDA, would recommend JN.1 like the WHO, or whether they would recommend one of the flirt variants, as you mentioned, KN.2 or KN.3. And their general recommendation was JN.1 at this point. So none of this is a surprise. We certainly want to update our vaccine. It's important to put it in perspective of a year ago, we made a decision based upon XBB.1, which was circulating then and causing disease in last spring. And by the time the fall came around, XBB.1 was gone, but that's what our vaccine was directed against. And the new kid on the block, if you will, was JN.1, and that's what caused disease. It was fortunate that the vaccine that we developed against XBB.1 last year worked against JN.1. The reason I wanted to go into that with all that alphabet soup is that we put a lot of work into trying to pick the best match for what we think will be going on in the fall, but we need a lag time of about 3 months. And so we struggle with that, but I think that the realization is that, at least given what we experienced last year, is that a recent vaccine against relatively recently seen subvariants tends to have broad protection. And so the vaccine we created last spring worked well against something that wasn't really very closely related to it. So that gives me hope that no matter what we pick for the fall, it's likely to work quite well, very much like the vaccine did last fall, and for those who repeated it again this spring.
As I understand it, there's not a huge genetic difference between JN.1 and KP.2 and KP.3. One would assume that a vaccine targeting one would work relatively effectively for the others.
That's the thinking. There's every reason to think that that's the case. The data that was presented would suggest that. So I think that everything's going forward, and I think we're going forward in a very reasonable way. Now, there's still some other opinions that have to come in. As you mentioned, this is the FDA's advisory committee. It's a committee of people outside of the government who are advising the FDA. But ultimately, the FDA is going to make a decision. So the FDA could say, no, we don't agree, and we want to approve KN.2 or KN.3. The other, then from there, it goes to the CDC that has its own independent advisory committee called ACIP. And that's going to occur later this month. And they're going to advise the CDC as to what to do. And ultimately, the CDC will make the final decision. So we have three more hurdles to go through. But I think it's very likely it's going to be based upon JN.1, with the outside possibility that there might be a change to one of the flirt variants.
All right, let's bring in some listener questions. We think we have the phone quality finally fixed this week. So 1-800-958-9008 for your corona calls. First up, we've got Holly in San Francisco. Good morning, Holly.
Yeah, good morning. I got COVID in the middle of March, just days before it was announced I could get the booster. And I'm wondering now, should I get that booster now that it's been, you know, a few months, or should I wait for fall for the new booster?
Holly, if you're not at marked increased risk for disease, that is if you're not severely immunocompromised, you're still receiving significant benefit from your immune response to your episode of COVID in March. That is, you still have considerable protection. That protection varies between individuals, but typically gives you very good protection for 2 or 3 months, and then it wanes pretty significantly. So it's possible that I'm going to assume that you're at moderate increased risk by, I'll just assume you're at moderate increased risk because you were planning on getting the booster. I think you're going to have good protection through April, May, and June this month, and fairly good protection for serious disease for much of the rest of the summer. So unless you're at very high risk of a bad outcome, I would suggest that if I was in your shoes, I would probably wait until getting a new booster in the fall. Now, if I was really seriously immunocompromised, then 3 months after that episode of 3 or 4 months after the episode of COVID that you had in March, I would get the additional booster and then wait 3 or 4 months for the new updated vaccine to come out in the fall. So that's generally how I would view this. I can't tell you what you should do, but I can generally speak to that issue.
All right. Hope that's helpful, Holly. Let's take one from the inbox. Alice in. In the last week, I've incidentally heard of 10 people with COVID, whereas normally the number of cases I hear about in any given week had been zero.
Yeah. You know, I've had the same experience as Allison has, and that is that I have a very close friend right now with COVID. That he got when he went to his grandchild's graduation. And I know several people have had COVID recently. And it seems like in my anecdotal experience, like with Allison, that, I'm seeing a little bit more right now. But the problem is, and Brian, you and I have talked about this, we don't have data. We have the wastewater data that shows that the Western Division of the United States has increased wastewater evidence of COVID. And when you drill down and look at that data, it looks like it's California that is driving that. The other Western states don't seem to have the same levels in the wastewater as California does. So the wastewater data would suggest that there's a lot more COVID going on right now in the community. If you look at influenza-like illnesses, we are still a little bit high in the Bay Area and in California in general than where we would anticipate being. And that would suggest that some of this is COVID. But we don't have the data that we had even a year ago, and certainly not 2 years ago, to really know with certainty. When we look at hospitalizations, we're not seeing a significant uptick. We've seen a little bit of rise here in California, but not dramatic. And when we look at deaths, we're not seeing any uptick of any significance. So This drives people who, like me, who look at the data very carefully, to be really frustrated that we can't answer Holly's Allison's question with any kind of accuracy. But the sense is that we are in somewhat of a swell of cases right now.
Like you, Dr. Swartzberg, I've been looking at those wastewater dashboards as kind of like a reasonable proxy for how much COVID is out there. But I have these nagging questions about the usefulness of that data for long-term comparisons. Like I understand you get COVID, some of it winds up in your poop, that winds up in the wastewater. That's what they measure. But it doesn't account for if, say, some new variant sheds more virus into the gut than previous variants. So it drives up the wastewater levels to a higher viral count per case than previously. Or conversely, if people who get less sick because they're now previously vaccinated or previously infected or both shed less virus in their poop per case of COVID, is it useful to read those wastewater charts over a 2-year span to try to draw, conclusions over where we are now versus, say, the peak of Omicron?
It's somewhat useful, and I'm going to really underline three times somewhat. The caveats that you just expressed are absolutely valid. And you can add to that the fact that we brought new wastewater testing sites up since 2 years ago. So it's really comparing apples to oranges here. I think that what we're struggling with wastewater is that it's a new tool. It wasn't even around at the beginning of the pandemic. So it's a very new tool, and we're still trying to learn how best to use it. The problem we're having right now, as we've just been discussing, is that it's one of the only tools we have to really give us a sense of where we are right now. And so that's why, it's that old quip about if the only tool you have is a hammer, all the world looks like nails. And the only tool we really have that's are The major tool we really have is wastewater right now to give us a sense of what's happening at this moment.
Safe to say it's more useful over shorter runs to see if COVID levels are trending up or trending down than it is over longer runs to draw some kind of comparison with 2 years ago.
Yes, I think that's safe to say that. So if we look at what's happening right now and compare it to 2 months ago and a month ago, that's, I think, very helpful. But if we look at influenza in wastewater, influenza RNA in wastewater, we see high levels in certain parts of the country right now where we see low levels of influenza-like illness. And we think that may very well be due to not influenza in humans, but influenza in dairy farms and perhaps other animals that are shedding it into the wastewater, because the wastewater we're looking at is not just human poop, as you were describing, but it's poop in general. So that confounds our thinking a little bit, at least in reference to influenza.
All right, let's bring in some more questions from our audience. Susan is on the line in San Francisco. Good morning, Susan.
Hi, I'm 70. I'd never had COVID before. I tested positive on May 29th. And then the day after that, I started taking Paxlovid. I took it the 5-day dose. Most of the symptoms went away. And then yesterday, the symptoms started coming back, like cold symptoms, coughing, having to blow my nose constantly, a slight fever. Is there like a rebound of, can there be like a rebound of Paxlovid?
Well, Susan, I'm sorry that you have rebounded, but that's what it sounds like. This occurs around 15% of the time. Some studies suggest 20% of the time. And it occurs if you've taken Paxlovid. It occurs if you didn't take Paxlovid. So we're not calling it Paxlovid rebound any longer. We're calling it COVID rebound because it could have occurred even if you didn't take Paxlovid. Some studies suggest that it may occur a little more frequently if you've taken Paxlovid, but others don't confirm that. So it does sound like you are experiencing rebound right now, and you do sound quite nasal on the telephone. The good news is that almost always the rebound is significantly less severe than the original episode. So it's very likely that this rebound that you're having, although very annoying and bothersome and inconvenient, is not going to be as bad as what you went through when you developed this on May 29th.
Dr. Schwarzberg, what do we understand about the mechanism that makes rebound milder? Is it that like the last holdouts of COVID are in some part of your body that's not as consequential?
We the on the major hypothesis we have, and it remains a hypothesis at this point, is that with the initial episode of COVID, you develop an immune response, and that's why you get well. If you rebound, it means that that immune response, at least according to the hypothesis, the immune response was good, but not adequate to completely suppress the viral replication. And so the virus is continuing to infect cells and cause some symptomatology. It wreaks its ugly head up again. But you have a lot of antibodies around still, and you have your not only your B cells that produce the antibodies, but your T cells all ramped up at this point. So you have a lot of defenses. So even though the virus is starting to replicate again, you have enough defenses to quell the amount of damage that the virus does and makes the experience less severe.
I guess, you know, I had a like very similar course of rebound to what our caller just described. And when I was initially sick with COVID, you know, it felt like it was everywhere. I had a fever, I had chills, you know, it felt like a systemic response. When I rebounded, I just had nasal congestion and basically nothing else. It was like the Paxlovid, I took Paxlovid, had helped my body purge COVID from everywhere except my nose. And I guess that's the mental shortcut I've been taking to think of what a typical rebound case looks like the antibodies my body started cranking out during the 5 days that I was on the antivirals just couldn't get everywhere in my nasal passage, but they had cleared my lungs and my blood and everything else.
Yeah, I think Brian, your experience is pretty much textbook, and that is, it's exactly what most people describe.
All right.
Hopefully, that'll be the same season.
Sure will be. All right, we have a question that is on the topic of another disease. Karen, who is planning some travel this summer, says in some of the places she is traveling, pertussis cases are up as much as 770%. She asks, will the N95 I've been wearing for COVID help me not get pertussis?
Right, pertussis or whooping cough continues to be a problem. And to a large extent, this is because of under immunization, but it's also because our vaccines against pertussis don't last a lifetime. So the answer to Karen's question is yes, an N95 will do very well to protect her against getting pertussis. The other thing that may be important for her is that because the vaccine doesn't last a lifetime, if she's not gotten a pertussis booster since her childhood, then she should get that, and that will give her a boost in protection. So all adults who have not been at an updated pertussis booster since childhood should be sure to get that.
Is that a routine vaccination that your doctor will notify you need to get in a regular checkup, or is this like ordering off the secret menu?
No, it should be pretty routine. This has been established by the CDC for several years now. It's you may have heard of the name DPT vaccine, diphtheria,
Diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus.
right? As adults, we were just getting the DT because we already had pertussis as a child, but a number of years ago, because of these episodes like what Karen's discussing that happened here in the United States as well, that it's a good idea for instead of getting your DT every 10 years when you're due for that, or even a little sooner, get the DPT once, and that will boost your immunity.
Good to know. All right. The time has run out on us. Dr. Swartzberg, thanks for spending another Monday morning with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. We ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.